Hello, everyone. My name is Dylan Scott, and I work as the Assistant Director of External Relations here at DWC. Happy to have you all with us today. We've got a lot of information to get through, so I want to be mindful of your time and get started. As y'all know, these meetings are posted on our website. The link for that is available on the last slide of this presentation. We want to welcome everyone to DWC's quarterly stakeholder meeting. We are happy to have you with us so we can give y'all an update on what's happening here at the division. These meetings are intended to be informal and to encourage open communication between DWC staff and our system participants. We welcome your feedback and will do our best to answer any questions that y'all may have. After the meeting, if you have any feedback or additional questions, please don't hesitate to reach out to the External Relations team. You can shoot us a message to dwcexternalrelations@tdi.texas.gov, and we'll also have that address on the last slide. Now we'll have Commissioner Nelson get us started.
Hello, welcome to our redone quarterly meeting for January 2026. I want to start off by apologizing for the audio issues that we had last week. Obviously, that's not the standard we hold ourselves to and not what you all have come to expect from us. In an effort to try to make up for that as best as we can, we've decided to re-record the presentation and provide it to you all. So I hope you find this useful. There will also be an opportunity to email us any questions that you have after the fact. So there'll be some information for that email at the end of this presentation. So to start, I did want to mention air ambulance. As a lot of you know, last Friday, there was a big decision from the State Office of Administrative Hearings on the rate of air ambulance services. The judge decided to look at each individual case and take a fair and reasonable rate on that. It was around 140 to 150% of Medicare. That is a decision that we are reviewing right now to see what the next steps are, but I did just want to get that out of the way that for now, we don't have much other information provided other than that. For this year, what I thought we would do is take a look back at 2025, sort of like a Spotify wrapped year in review, to see what all we've done for the system and what all has gone on in our system. So really to start, just a kind of a system overview. In the Texas workers' comp system, we have about 304,000 workers' comp policies that were written last year. There's about 325 carriers writing workers' comp in the state. That shows a very competitive market. Last year, we had about 81,000 claims, and that's down from about 90,000 the previous year, but it's pretty consistent with where we've been over the past 4 or 5 years. Here at the division, we processed 1.3 million documents, and we also handled about just under 13,000 dispute proceedings. And those proceedings include benefit review conferences and contested case hearings. All in, we had about 6,500 total disputes on individual claims. For customer service, which I think we do exceptionally well, we handled about 121,000 calls. That's both in English and Spanish. We have a 15-second wait time. That's not being placed on hold. That's from the time you call till someone picks up the phone. And we pick up the phone in real time. You're not going through an AI prompt to try to get to the right person to handle your specific issue. I think we do a very good job of that. And we provide real customer service to insurance carriers, injured employees, healthcare providers. For healthcare providers, we have our Comp Connection hotline. We had just under 1,500 providers call that connection hotline last year. And they're getting answers on billing requirements, treatment guidelines, anything that pertains to the work that they do or their front office staff do. That's what we're there to help. And customer service doesn't just stop there. We look at it as our compliance department as well. And that compliance department helped return about $2.4 million to system participants through their efforts, which I think is something that we're proud of. And I know they're very proud of too. We also launched a few new tools in 2025, which I think helped improve transparency and also efficiency in our system. We created a benefit estimator. This is something really intended for injured employees so that they can put in information about their claim and get a sense of what benefits they might be entitled to. This really isn't a replacement for adjusters or attorneys to calculate what benefits an injured employee is owed, but really to get a rough estimate of what they may or may not be entitled to. We also created a few searchable databases. One is for our consent orders. That is a much more navigatable system and has much better search functions for keyword searches, not just information that you find in the title, as well as our appeals panel manual. That appeals panel manual is now very easy to navigate and search. If you haven't had a chance to take a look at that, I encourage you all to go take a look at both of those new search functions. We also have improved modernization through some of the technology that we have and that we provided to the system. To start, we opened up telemedicine and telehealth exams for treating doctors to do impairment ratings. Now, it is limited to just claims with no impairment, but it's something that we've seen a lot of doctors taking advantage of. It's really helped speed up the process. It's something that insurance carriers had asked for a long time, sort of to help close these very minor injury claims to kind of get those off the books. The treating doctors out there are not taking advantage of it. I hope it's something that they take a look at because we do think it's been a big benefit. We do see that it's helped us speed up the claims process. We also have automated a bunch of correspondence. Now, this is really helps efficiency for us, but it also improves accuracy. So when we automate all the mailing, all the information that gets sent out from us, it gets the information to you faster and more accurately. So that's been a big focus of ours really for the past 4 or 5 years, but we put a big emphasis on automating a lot of that correspondence this year. We also put together a designated doctor report template. I think this is something that was a long time coming. It's not a required template, but it's a template that's out there for designated doctors to use to complete their reports. And this brings standardization for our judges when they're reviewing designated doctor reports, adjusters when they're reviewing these reports, and it helps the doctors as well so that they know exactly what elements they need to include in them. We've seen a lot of DDs using it. We are encouraging them as much as we can to continue to use it and to adopt it. We're working with scheduling companies so that they know what's available out there and that they can start putting it into their system. It's been a big benefit. It's only been in place for a few months now, but we're really hoping over the next, 3 to 6 months, we really see a big adoption of that. And the last thing I wanted to touch on for now is our trainings. One of our primary responsibilities under the Workers' Compensation Act is to educate system participants on how the system works. Workers' comp is complicated. It's a very niche system. It takes a long time to become really a subject matter expert in it. We want to help make it easier for people to come into our system and understand how it works. So to do that, we've done healthcare provider boot camps throughout the year. We had over 2,600 attendees at those boot camps. And this is for healthcare providers as well as their front office staff to help them understand billing, to help them understand the forms that they're getting in, to help them understand the treatment guidelines, the pre-authorization process. And those have been a big hit and something we're going to continue. We also had our designated doctor webinars. We had 31 of these events and we had 650 attendees come. And those are just ongoing trainings for our doctors to remind them on calculations of impairment ratings, what goes into extent of injury disputes, just refreshers on a lot of different topics that have really been a big help. And I think judging by the number of attendees we have, that they really enjoy it. We also have our comp courses, which has been a big hit. We've had over 1,300 attendees at our 4 comp courses this past year, and they received just under 600 continuing education credits. This is something we're going to continue with. We are trying to do a range of topics from workers' comp 101 beginner topics to really in-depth topics on how to fill out wage statements and specific forms that are required to be filled out. So we've gotten a lot of great feedback on that. Expect to see more of those coming from us soon. The last thing, we had our in-person conference. That's something we're going to stick with. We had about 500 attendees this year. The conference is going to be at the same location next year. It's going to be in early September. Stay tuned for some more information on that. And that's all I have for now before I turn it over to Amy Rich, but I will have a little bit of information at the end. Again, we are sorry for the technical difficulties that we had previously, but we hope this helped make up for that. Amy.
Hey, everyone. My name is Amy Rich. I am in the healthcare provider and return to work outreach and education area. I wanted to give you a quick update regarding our program area. Want to talk about the 2026 non-network professional and workers' comp specific exam reimbursement rates. This topic was covered in a webinar we held on January 15th. That video of that webinar is now posted on our healthcare provider on-demand video webpage for your viewing. You can have your staff look at it and understand what has changed for 2026 as relating to workers' compensation professional and workers' comp specific exam reimbursement rates. When I say workers' comp specific exam reimbursement rates, I'm talking about maximum medical improvement, impairment ratings, extent of injury, those exams and the like. As you know, the division publishes our new conversion factors in the fall every year after the new Medicare Economic Index, or MEI, is published by the federal government. The MEI is a weighted average of price changes to the cost to deliver physician services. Our, or the division conversion factors, are based on that MEI. And because of that, the division conversion factors have increased by 2.7% this year. You will see on the right in the table that our conversion factors are $72.07 for office procedures. That's in-office procedures like office visits, physical medicine, that sort of thing. And then $90.48 for professional surgery charges while the injured employee or the patient is in the facility. Incidentally, Medicare has published two conversion factors also. I'm not talking about the anesthesia conversion factors, but they've published two conversion factors. One for those healthcare providers participating in their quality improvement plan, I'm going to call it QPP, and those providers that are not participating, a non-QPP conversion factor. This has caused some questions coming into Comp Connection regarding which conversion factor from the Medicare side applies in our system. The answer is neither apply. Remember, our methodology replaces the Medicare conversion factors with ours in the reimbursement methodology. So using the quick calculation, which was explained in the webinar, our non-network reimbursement rates for 2026 are 216% of the non-QPP Medicare reimbursement amounts for in-office procedures, and 271% of non-QPP amounts for professional surgery services when the patient is in a facility. So using that quick calculation, you will get very close to our maximum allowable reimbursement, but it could be off a few cents here and there. So it's just an approximate amount. The most precise amount is using the long calculation. Again, it's explained in our video that's posted on our website. This slide gives you an example of an established office visit in Austin, Texas, using the quick calculation. You will look up the non-QPP Medicare reimbursement amount and then multiply times that 2.16 or 216%. This ends up being $211.18, which is, again, an approximate MAR amount for this services. These amounts are not rounded up like the workers' comp specific exams. And for the most precise calculation, again, you will need to use the long reimbursement method explained in our webinar. Now, because the MEI went up by 2.7%, we also updated our workers' comp specific exams by that percentage, like MMI, impairment rating, extent of injury, and return to work exams. You will find these new rates in the exam fee table, just under the conversion factor table on that same web page. There's a few ways to search for this page, and you can look under designated doctor exam fees, certifying doctor exam fees, or just C for conversion factor page. This is using the workers' comp A through Z function, not the A through Z function on the very top of our web page. It is the specific workers' comp A through Z. Now, these amounts you'll find in that column to the right for 2026, they have been rounded to the nearest whole dollar amounts. If you're scratching your head on the 2026 professional fee rates or the workers' comp exam fee rates, you'll be able to watch that video from our webinar on our webpage. Next thing I want to let you know is that we would love for you to join us. Both healthcare providers and other system participants like insurance carriers are welcome to the 2026 bootcamp series. We will conduct our first bootcamp at the end of February, February 24th, and the next one later in the summer. And these are like 8 high intensity trainings on Tuesdays and Thursdays for our system participants to learn about workers' compensation. And finally, all of our webinars, like I've been talking about, are recorded and placed on our healthcare provider on-demand webpage. And because all the webinars we conducted over the last few years have been posted on here, this page has gotten a little cluttered. We are reorganizing this webpage to have just the most recent video topics and resource documents available to you. That change is coming soon, so keep an eye out for that. And thank you so much. Now I'll turn it over to Jennifer Self.
Hello. I'm Jennifer Self, and I oversee healthcare quality and review under the Office of the Medical Advisor. In calendar year 2025, the Office of the Medical Advisor received 80 complaints. Of these, 43 were closed with no action, 21 were resolved through letters of education, and 17 resulted in formal medical quality reviews. In total, 81 complaints were closed by ailment. During the same period, the Medical Quality Review Panel conducted 11 complaint-based reviews, 10 plan-based audits, and completed 384 performance-based oversight audits. Of the PBO audits, 158 were found acceptable, while 226 required improvement. These results reflect both high volume and continued opportunities for provider education and strengthening. This year's audit activity targeted key risk and impact areas. The gabapentin and pregabalin plan-based audit resulted in education for 7 providers and closure for 3 cases with no further action. Findings were published to the OMA webpage, marking a new process we initiated with the executive summary at the end of last year. The performance-based oversight audit evaluated return-to-work measures across 384 DeWitt 73 forms, providing measurable insight into functional outcome reporting. Additionally, the designated doctor plan-based audit launched with a posted audit plan covering 8 to 10 subjects, with up to 5 cases per subject. Findings are on track for publication later this spring, and results will be posted on the OMA page, the same as we did for the gabapentin audit executive summary. Finally, the annual audit plan was posted for public comment and focuses on prescribing topical analgesics and evaluating URA peer review practices for compliance with ODG, standards of care, and evidence-based medicine. This posting was extended longer than average because of the holidays, and we wanted to allow sufficient time to get feedback. Last week was our deadline, and I'm currently reviewing these comments to pass along to our medical advisor and deputy commissioner. More to come on that for next quarter. To support transition planning, over 300 cases were reviewed to compare impairment ratings between the AMA 4th and 6th editions. Because the AMA has since released an updated 2025 version last month, DeWitt plans to research the 2024 and 2025 versions to determine which version to adopt as the final standard. Findings for this study were presented to the Research Evaluation Group, or the REG, to guide implementation, and their results should be completed possibly late spring as well. We would like to thank our NQRP members for this research and work ensuring strong clinical and operational alignment with the AMA recommendations. Together, all of these projects, our team and medical advisor have demonstrated continued commitment to quality oversight, evidence-based practice, and responsible stewardship of the workers' compensation system. We appreciate their partnership and dedication of our teams and stakeholders, and we look forward to continuing this work into the next quarter. Thank you very much for your time.
Hi, I'm Greg Arndt. I'm the Director of Medical Fee Dispute Resolution, and I just wanted to quickly review 3 topics. First is going to go over the calendar year 2025 medical fee disputes, both received and closed. We received about 3,700 fee disputes in calendar year 2025. That's the most we've received since 2019, actually. During the COVID pandemic, we dropped to about 2,500 in 2020 and 2021. We recovered over 3,000 from 2022 to 2024. And again, we did increase a little bit in 2025 to 3,700 disputes. The mix of the disputes that we received has pretty much been consistent for the past 5 years. DWC-specific disputes are the most common still, followed by professional services and then facility disputes. The mix, again, has been consistent for about the past 5 years. The last time there was a big change was in 2018 and 2019 when we had the compounded drug disputes. So in those years, the pharmacy disputes were by far the highest that we had. We would receive thousands of disputes on that alone. As far as division DWC specific disputes, that includes not just designated doctor disputes, it's designated doctor disputes, disputes over maximum medical improvement and impairment ratings filed by treating doctors, functional capacity evaluations, chronic pain management, work hardening, work conditioning. So it is our highest number of disputes received, but it encompasses a lot of different types of disputes. You'll also notice that we have the numbers received and closed are usually pretty close together. We are cycling through the disputes pretty quickly. For a dispute that was received in 2025, we averaged about 55 days for it to be closed. So we are cycling through the disputes relatively quickly. I wanted to go over some common issues with fee disputes. First, reconsideration is not often being done by healthcare providers prior to filing their fee dispute. It is a requirement for a healthcare provider to file for reconsideration before coming into medical fee dispute. How it should happen is a healthcare provider will send their initial bill to the insurance carrier. The insurance carrier will have 45 days to either pay, reduce, or deny that bill. If the healthcare provider is not happy with the insurance carrier's action, they need to file a reconsideration. The insurance carrier will have 30 days to pay, reduce, or deny on the reconsideration. What we're seeing right now is sometimes the healthcare providers are not doing that reconsideration. It is a requirement prior to coming into medical fee dispute. We may dismiss your fee dispute if you do not file the reconsideration. There are also time frames. You only have 10 months from the date of service to actually file for reconsideration. And then there is a 1 year to MFDR deadline from the date of service for you to file for a fee dispute. So if you file for a fee dispute without reconsideration and we dismiss it, you may be missing deadlines for both reconsideration and MFDR by not doing this. So please always file reconsiderations. The second thing for the requesters is the healthcare providers must follow the required billing forms formats found in section 133.10 for a bill to be considered complete. An example of this is going to be on the designated doctors when there is a missed appointment fee. It's not really, you know, even a service, but it is still on a bill. You do have to fill in all the medical billing forms completely for it to be considered at MFDR. For respondents, we still do get a sizable percentage of disputes where the insurance carrier just does not respond to it. In calendar year 2025, it was 13%. That's a little bit lower than it was in 2024 and much lower than it was at the height of when in 2020, it was at about 20% actually. So we do need a response from the insurance carriers. Even if you're just saying, I'm going to pay for the disputed services, please always send that response in. Something that we're very excited about is we are working on an online portal for dispute submission by the healthcare providers and response by the insurance carriers. So requesters will be able to submit medical fee disputes and insurance carriers will be able to respond using this new online portal. So a little bit of history, MFDR was one of the last purely paper processes at the division. Until 2021, a healthcare provider had to put in not only paper, but two copies of a paper dispute for it to be considered a complete dispute or a valid dispute to MFDR. We would take the second copy, the second paper copy, and send it to the insurance carrier. So in 2021, we made the submission process a lot easier and more efficient by allowing for submission by email, fax, or SFTP. So this online portal is going to be even easier and more efficient. And it's some of the advantages to it are the MFDR tracking number is going to be available to the healthcare provider, the requester, immediately. How it works right now, even if you put it in via electronic means, we receive it, we docket it, and then we have to send your acknowledgement of the fee dispute with the tracking number to the healthcare providers via ground mail. So that can take weeks. And so we'll have a healthcare providers ask, what's the status of the dispute? And they'll give us a name and we need the tracking number. So that tracking number, which will be on your dispute till the end of it, is available to requesters immediately. Another very good thing about it is requesters can view the status of all the disputes submitted, including those that have been adjudicated or closed. So when I first started working for a medical fee dispute many years ago, one of my jobs was to actually respond to an inquiry line. So over the years, I've responded to thousands of emails from healthcare providers asking, what is the status of my dispute? With this new system, all the healthcare provider will have to do is just log into their portal and they can see the status of every dispute that they've put in. So no more emails than waiting at one business day for a response that it has been. You'll be able to see the status of all disputes right away. One good thing for the carriers is the carriers can upload their responses directly to the dispute folder. Currently, when the insurance carriers respond, say through SFTP, that response has to be triaged to the actual correct place into the dispute folder. Carriers will be able just to put in their responses directly to the folder. So again, we are working on this online portal. It's going to be to be determined when it will be active, but and we may be asking for some feedback from some of y'all. So, but we are very excited about that. And that's what I have, and I'm going to hand it over now to Martha Loevno.
Hi, everybody. My name is Martha Levin. I'm the Director of Enterprise Automation Systems, and I will be giving you a brief update of our goals for the next year and talk a little bit about PBO. All right. So some of our main 2026 initiatives for the Enterprise Automation Services section is number one for the DD exam services. That's a program area that I recently transferred over to my department as of September. And what we're going to focus on is outreach to designated doctors, teaching them how to use text comp to view and print orders and to do other things. We generally do have pretty good use of those features, but there are a few designated doctors that maybe don't know about them or need a little help getting through those screens. So we're going to be focusing our efforts on outreach so that we can minimize the number of faxes and that we're being asked to send out orders and things like that to designated doctors. So we're going to be doing that throughout the year. Next initiative for designated doctor exam services is about monitoring. So we're going to start producing reports for designated doctors and their agents. As you all know, my department also has PBO, but we don't want to be doing reviews or focusing on compliance just every other year like we do with the healthcare provider PBO. We want to make sure that there's consistent and frequent communication with designated doctors and their agents so that they know how they're doing in terms of timeliness of filing DWIC 69s. And also what their reschedule percentages are. We generally think that reschedule should be an exception and not the rule. So we're going to start working with you all on that. And then the last thing is process improvement. So there's a lot of administrative work that goes into processing requests for designated doctor exams and scheduling. And so we're going to go in and streamline those processes, improve quality, and hopefully be able to process those 32 a little quicker. For claim EDI, this is the next step of monitoring. We're going to start looking at more complicated reports, not just, you know, simple reports like first reports of injuries or IPs. Everything seems to be pretty good in those categories. And we are very satisfied with the performance of claim administrators in that sense. But now we're going to start looking at more complicated reports. Lump sum payment reports are required, and you know, this is something that you all probably know, when there is an agreement to pay or a DWIC form for a 24, after indemnity payments are ordered, and also payments to the CIF. So we're going to be monitoring for that, and we're going to coordinate with the hearing section, and we're going to be getting data from that side so that we can confirm the carriers are filing these reports after these events occur. And last but not least, medical EDI. First of all, we're going to start monitoring more of that medical EDI, and we're going to start producing reports for trading partners. Now, medical state reporting has a relatively small group of folks that are actually doing the EDI filing on behalf of carriers and on behalf of trading partners. So we're going to take advantage of that and start doing outreach to every single one, just asking them what they want to see on those compliance reports. And we're hopefully going to be able to get them that information on a monthly basis. The other outreach initiative is in reporting of the authorization number. So this goes back and it's related to DD exam services. There's an authorization number that is the designated doctor order number that we want reported to the division. And the reason that we need that number is to be able to understand if a bill is related to a designated doctor order or if it is not. So we've already started working with trading partners, and we've had a very successful test with one trading partner that successfully implemented DN-0581. So we're going to keep going with the rest of the trading partners, and that would be hopefully something that we will get done before the end of the year. Okay, so now going on to PBO. So one of the high-level points that I want to make on this screen is that regardless of what year it is, our staff is working on PBO every single month. Okay, so there's responsibilities that we have. So even if we're not conducting a performance-based oversight, we're working on the one that's coming up for the following year. Starting with this year, 2026 is an insurance carrier assessment year. The schedule is pretty much the same. The assessment plan was posted on our website. Feel free to check it out. All of the measures are the same. And so there's very little changes for this. So be sure to check that out. The schedule is going to start, of course, in July with the results are being sent to the carriers and then will be completed in October. For healthcare provider PBO, the 2025 results were posted in November of 2025 and the 2027 assessment plan we hope to have posted in August. And that's all for my presentation. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Jeff Carruthers, Regional Director for Hearings for the Southern and Eastern Regions. My presentation will be focused on current operations and upcoming considerations within the hearings area. First, I have some statistics regarding proceedings concluded. This would be benefit review conferences and contested case hearings concluded for fiscal years 2018 through 2026. At the outset, our focus in hearings does remain on moving cases to resolution while maintaining due process and procedural consistency. For benefit review conferences, looking at the multi-year trend, BRC volumes declined from fiscal year 2018 through fiscal year 2020, which does align with broader system disruptions during that period. Beginning in fiscal year 2021, BRC volumes stabilized and then increased steadily through fiscal year 2025, reaching levels comparable to pre-pandemic years. The fiscal year 2026 number reflects only activity through November 30th, so it represents a partial year and should not be viewed as a full year comparison. So for contested case hearings, CCH volumes show a gradual downward trend over time, even as BRC activity rebounded. This suggests that more disputes are being narrowed or resolved earlier rather than progressing automatically to contested case hearings. Similar to BRC's, the fiscal year 2026 CCH figure is a partial year number reflecting activity through November of last year only. Next are rule updates. Hearings is currently working on updating the arbitration rules in Chapter 144. And an informal working draft was published last year for stakeholder review. Although no parties have ever elected arbitration in the Texas workers' compensation system, the statute does allow for it, and the rules need to be current and operational in the event arbitration is ever requested. The proposed updates are largely technical and non-substantive in nature, such as updating citations and removing obsolete references, eliminating provisions that duplicate the labor code, and improving clarity, formatting, and internal consistency. One substantive focus is expanding and clarifying the pool of qualified arbitrators, so the system is prepared if arbitration is elected. This would be ALJs with at least 2 years of experience would be added to the pool of arbitrators. So these updates are not expected to impact current dispute resolution practices, but they would ensure the arbitration option is viable, compliant, and ready if used. Next, some information about interpreter services. Interpreter availability is becoming more limited for certain languages, particularly the less common languages. At the same time, costs for interpreter services continue to increase dramatically statewide. In response, Hearings is piloting alternative service delivery models to improve both access to interpreter services and overall efficiency. So just a brief overview of the pilot. Hearings will be piloting a project that allows interpreters to appear remotely for contested case hearings. The initial pilot is anticipated to begin in the Dallas field office. The pilot is designed to test different configurations depending on whether the hearing itself is conducted remotely or in person. The goal of the pilot is to better understand what works operationally while maintaining fairness and clarity in the hearing process. For remote hearings, where all parties appear by Zoom, the pilot will use Zoom's interpreter tools. During the general aspects of the hearing, such as the judge's opening statements, and closing arguments, the interpreter will provide simultaneous interpretation to the claimant through a dedicated language channel. When it comes time for the claimant's testimony, the claimant will be returned to the main channel and the interpreter will provide consecutive interpretation. This approach would allow the hearing to proceed efficiently while ensuring the claimant can fully participate. For in-person hearings, the interpreter will still appear remotely via Zoom. The claimant will be provided a device with headphones, and the ALJ will use a speaker and microphone for the hearing room. During the general parts of the hearing, the interpreter will provide simultaneous interpretation through the Zoom interpreter channel through the claimant's headphone device. And then when it comes time for the claimant to testify, the ALJ will switch to the Zoom main channel and the interpreter will provide consecutive interpretation. This setup would allow hearings to test remote interpreter participation without changing the in-person nature of the hearing. So looking ahead for interpreter services, hearings is exploring the potential use of AI-based interpretation tools. This work is strictly in the investigation and evaluation stage, and no decisions have been made regarding implementation. But any future use would require careful evaluation for accuracy, reliability, and due process concerns. So the last topic I'd like to discuss is communication with hearings. I do want to highlight the importance of using the correct communication channels when communicating with hearings. This slide lists out several of those communication channels. First, we have Secure File Transfer Protocol, otherwise referred to as SFTP. I recommend this channel of communications if you need to send a large electronic file to the division, such as an audio file or video file that you anticipate using in a proceeding. Next, we have TextComp, which allows for the uploading of documents. If you ever have any questions about how to set up an account or a profile to use either SFTP or TextComp, please refer to our hearings webpage. We have that information there. Next, our PROs, our proceeding resolution officers. If you ever need to communicate with a BRO or an ALJ, please do so through the PRO. We do have a list of all of our PROs on our hearings webpage, together with their email address, as well as each PRO's assigned officers. We also have on the slide our key email addresses for submitting BRC exchanges and CCH exhibits. Please do note that there is an underscore between BRC and exchanges and CCH and exhibits. Lastly is our fax number for hearings, 512-804-4011. Again, using the correct channel of communication helps ensure materials are received and processed accordingly. And that concludes the hearings update.
Thanks for being here. My name is Dan LeBrier. I am the Deputy Commissioner of Compliance and Investigations. We're about a little more at this point than a quarter of the way through the fiscal year. So we've got a little bit of data that I'd like to share with you to give you a little bit of insight into what we're working on and potentially maybe even what we can expect from the rest of the year by looking at the numbers that we have thus far. So I want to start in audits and investigations. For those of you unfamiliar with audits and investigations, these are the people that receive, process, and investigate complaints of administrative violations in the workers' compensation system. They stay busy year-round. They're constantly processing about, on average, 2,200 complaints, somewhere in that ballpark, and they're also consistently auditing throughout the entirety of the year. I do think that the types of complaints that we're receiving tell a story in the comp system. At least it's one indicator of health in the workers' compensation system. Kind of gives us some insight into what's going on. I'd say generally good news. Everything thus far this year looks a lot like last year. So if last year was a successful year for you, it's a little early, but it's looking like this year might be successful for you as well, which I take to be a good thing. Thus far, and again, this is only 90 days of data, we have received about 537 complaints. So extrapolating out, it looks like we're on track to do somewhere between 2,000 and 2,200 complaints this fiscal year, which again, totally normal for what we've been receiving these last three or four years, which is a good thing. We haven't seen a dramatic spike in any one area, which is, again, a good thing. There's a lot of stability in the system right now. So here we're looking at complaints that we've received by respondent type. Respondent is just a legal word for who the complaint is against. Nothing really new or striking in this data. This data, again, is looking a lot like the data has for the last couple of years. There are a couple of exceptions here that I'd like to point out. And if you look at this middle area here, you're going to see indemnity benefits. And if you look at the third column from the left, you're going to see insurance carrier. If you look at that number, it's 191. That's not significantly higher than we were at this same point last year, but it is higher. I don't think it's much of a cause for concern just yet, but it is a bit of a curiosity. So just keep an eye on those complaints if you're a carrier specifically, because they seem to be trending upward right now. Another area, if you look at communications and then go to that fourth column from the left, communications complaints against healthcare providers are up as well. Now, this is a trend that we saw basically all year last year, and it seems to be continuing in fiscal 2026. So again, something to keep an eye on if you are a healthcare provider. Make sure those reports are in on time. That's the driving factor in these communications complaints, at least from my perspective. It seems to be late reports. So understand your deadlines when you need to get things turned in. If you need extra time, in the overwhelming majority of instances, DWC is granting requests for extensions. So get those requests in early if you do need extra time. Otherwise, get those reports in a timely manner. Like I said, every year we are doing audits in the industry. We're in the early stages of this year's audits, but we're right on track for where we need to be. Our audit plan calls for these audits to be completed really in quarters 2, 3, and 4 of the year, more so on the 3 and 4 side. A lot of data to get through, but we are certainly working our way through right now. Last year, we returned about 2.4 million to system participants through the audits and investigations process, which is a number I'm very proud of. My team over in A&I really worked hard to ensure that we were investigating complaints and making sure that the aggrieved party was made whole as much as we can on our end. And it looks like this year we're on track to do about the same. Maybe a little bit more, but we could see a spike next quarter or in the third quarter. A lot of stuff tends to happen in the third quarter, it seems like, over here at DWC. But we've received almost $545,000 back, and that's money that goes straight back to system participants. That's money that's returned by way of the audits and investigations process. So a lot to be happy about there. Good things happening. Another bright point in all of this data is we're about 10% of the way through our lifetime income benefit and death benefit audits, which historically have been a major driving factor in the overall amount of penalties that DWC is taking against various system participants. We've got some good news. Of the two that we've completed thus far, we haven't identified any underpayments, which is fantastic. That is a huge success. I'm very happy about that. I hope that trend continues. Experience tells me that that's not likely to be the case. There are always some underpayments we're going to be identifying. But as it stands right now, we're in a pretty good place with our death benefit audits, which I'm very happy about. Let's turn to my enforcement unit, give you some insight into what they're doing. These are the people that handle the complaints after they've been confirmed, and these are the lawyers that are prosecuting these cases. The other side of the coin here is that this data is going to kind of mirror what's going on in audits and investigations, and that this year is looking a lot like last year was looking, which, again, I take as a good thing. It tells me that there's stability in the system and we aren't seeing any wild trends or anything like that. Thus far, through this first quarter of the year, we've closed 131 cases against various system participants, and we have 194 pending. So this is a manageable caseload for us. We're in a good place. And I think that's true for the industry, too. No dramatic spikes in anything, which, again, that's kind of the overarching message of this presentation, is that things are kind of just business as usual right now. We're looking here at the cases that we've closed by subject type or respondent. Most of our business is done with insurance carriers. That should be pretty intuitive, given some of the previous slides that you saw showing our complaint numbers. You know, our number one complaint is typically delivery of indemnity benefits of some sort. And, you know, it makes sense that insurance carriers are intimately involved with those types of issues. So we've closed 84 cases this year with insurance carriers. And you'll see that the second most common respondent there is going to be healthcare providers at 38 and 9 in this other category. In that other category, it's basically everybody else. It's a catch-all. It's attorneys, potentially employers. It's potentially injured employees. It's also the cases that we may have opened an error. So that's kind of a catch-all category. But as you can see, by and large, most of our business is done with insurance carriers. Here we're looking at cases pending by subject type. Now, these are just our open cases. No surprises on this slide. It is what you'd expect from the cases that we've been closing that you saw on the last slide. The majority of these are going to be with insurance carriers at 163, followed in a distant second by healthcare providers at 30. Here we're looking at the cases that we've closed by disposition type. That just means how we're resolving these cases, essentially. There are three main ways that we resolve our enforcement cases. They are consent orders and warning letters and other means. And we'll talk about that a little bit. DWC order is, by and large, it's something that's been negotiated between the parties. And all that means is it's basically a settlement agreement that you'd expect to see in other areas of the law. But basically, both sides have come to an agreement as to the facts and the penalty, and it goes to the commissioner for his approval. He signs it, and at that point, it's a final order. This other category here, warning letter, that's when we have identified a violation of some sort, but there are certain mitigating factors present, whether it's a first-time violation or it's the type of violation that doesn't pose a lot of potential for substantial harm to the system at large. Those are the types of things that we're issuing warning letters on. Now, there's no financial penalty associated with a warning letter, but it is what you'd expect. It's warning, and it tells you, hey, if you continue down this road, we may be actually assessing monetary penalties against you in the future. And this third category, other, that's going to be basically everything else. Again, it's a catch-all, but by and large, this is going to be letters of education. Now, this is when we've identified something that may be unorthodox, but it's not necessarily a violation of the labor code or a violation of the Texas Administrative Code. Kind of just an opportunity for us to educate on what we think are best practices. You'll see the data for insurance carriers in blue. You can see that by and large, we're closing our cases against insurance carriers through that order process. And then if you look at the data for healthcare providers in sort of gold, you're going to see that by and large, those cases are resolving through a warning letter. If you want to see what we're doing in our enforcement orders, basically those settlement agreements we've been coming to, you can find all of them on our website. Just go to the DWC page and scroll down to the bottom. You're going to see enforcement orders. You can click on that. And about a year ago, year and some change, we changed the, I guess you call it the script on all of these orders, or the way that they're searched is now much more intelligent. So it used to be you could only do like a keyword search of the title of the documents that appear on that page. Now you can keyword search any word that appears in any of those documents. So if you're really interested or just really keyed in on a particular issue, you can search for that issue by keyword or turn of a phrase at this point, which gives you, it's about 7 years of data at your fingertips. So you can get a pretty good idea of historically, you know, what was the market value of a violation, and also very recently, what's the current going rate for one of these violations. I want to talk real quick about fraud and my fraud prosecution unit over at the DA's office. Lots been going on. They've been off to a really great start this first quarter. And another thing I wanted to mention, last year, we began a project of basically trying to develop a curriculum for claims adjusters in order to better identify fraud at the early phases. Early identification of a fraudulent scheme is extremely important for a lot of reasons that I'm not going to get into because there's a lot of them. But for a lot of reasons, it is vital for us to get involved in these cases early on if we want to have a successful resolution over at the DA's office with the prosecution unit. Dust on the case file for the state is never a good thing. It never lends itself towards us reaching a more favorable resolution. So like I said, early intervention is key to these cases, and through y'all's help, and again, I want to say thank you to everybody who provided some of the information that we used in the curriculum. We've developed a training program. It's about 99 slides at this point, and what we're going to do is we're going to film it in February. We're going to have the director of my fraud unit and two of our absolute best and most experienced investigators presenting this information, and we're going to publish that for industry consumption. Really excited about that. I think it's going to help us get to a better place, better resolution for a lot of these fraud cases. And again, I just want to say thank you for everybody who participated in that. You know, getting that information is going to make that training curriculum much more effective. So thank you. We're off to a great start in our fraud units. We've opened 17 fraud cases in the first quarter. We closed 21, and we referred 4 cases over to the district attorney's office for prosecution. These are big numbers, and I don't anticipate that we will continue on this trend. It's a fairly small unit. It's a single prosecutor over at the DA's office that's handling all of these cases. We're kind of moving at breakneck speed right now, and that can't continue. But for what it's worth, off to a very good, very productive start in fiscal 26. Very happy about that. It is where the rubber meets the road. This is really the end result of all of these prosecutorial and investigative efforts. We've had 4 successful prosecutions in the last 3 months or so, which is really good. And this last number here, this 887,000, that's what I'm particularly proud of for my fraud teams. That's money that is actually received. Now, there are 2 types of restitution. There's the type of restitution that a judge orders a defendant to pay, and usually that defendant gets put on a payment plan over time. We don't always see that money. As you can imagine, criminals are not the easiest group of people to get money out of. It's very much blood from a stone. And then there's restitution received. These are actual dollars that we have received and distributed back to the victims of these offenses. So close to $1 million, fantastic work. Our prosecutor over at the DA's office has been working very hard behind the scenes, moving these cases and negotiating. And I expect that this is going to be a banner year for these fraud teams. Very good stuff coming down the line, and I'm very excited about it. We've been auditing the same 3 areas, lifetime income benefits and death benefits, temporary income benefits, and medical bill payment for a good long while now. And it's time for us to potentially turn our attention to other areas of the industry, other subjects, other topics, to see if, you know, if everybody's in compliance in other areas, particularly areas that we haven't looked at for quite some time. So you can expect to see that probably starting in September of 2026. That's going to be the beginning of fiscal 2027 for us. So for the next 7 or 8 months, it's going to be business as usual. We're going to get through our same 3 audits that we've been doing. But we are going to be focusing this year and turning our attention to new areas for us to potentially improve both internally and hopefully improve the external system as well. So keep an eye out for that. I will certainly get into that more as the year goes on at subsequent meetings. But for right now, just be aware that we are going to be looking at other things. One of those things is we're going to change the way that we're auditing death benefits. For the last at least 3 or 4 years, we've been looking at about 5 to 7 years worth of death benefit payments. So we've been looking at a lot of data all at once. The problem with that is that if there is an underpayment, and let's say the insurance carrier didn't catch it, that underpayment compounds for years and years and years and years. And the other part of that problem is that the enforcement unit, when they are evaluating these cases, their penalties that they're recommending are a dollar for dollar basis. So if there's a $10,000 underpayment over 7 years, then the penalty that we're valuing that case with is $10,000. If it's $100,000, then the penalty we're valuing that case at is $100,000. The problem is time. The longer the violation goes on, the more that these fines are going to be racking up. So what we want to do is we're going to go back a year. We're going to look at all of the compensable deaths in Texas for that year. And those are the claims that we're going to be auditing. So we're going to get closer to real time, and the value of that is going to be twofold. One, beneficiaries are going to be getting the benefits that they're entitled to more quickly than they would otherwise, which is obviously great for beneficiaries. The other thing is it's great for the carriers. It's going to be more work on our part, but the more work we're doing early on in these cases means y'all are going to be paying lower penalties, lower fines for these violations because they're not going to continue on for years and years. We're going to catch these early on. We're going to address it early on, and things are going to be better as far as penalties go. So we hope to be getting beneficiaries what they're entitled to early on. We hope also to lower our overall penalties through this strategy. So, you know, it's a change, and change can be scary, but I think it's going to be a good thing ultimately for everybody. One last topic here, and then I'll pass this on to Erica to give you the claims and customer service update. We've been crunching some numbers over here, and it looks like about 50% overall of the penalties that were taken last year were from 10 carriers. So we have about 300 carriers doing business in Texas. It's 10 that account for close to 50% of the overall penalties that we're taking in the entire state. Obviously, our methods, our tactics in the past are not working with these repeat offenders. These are the people that we see just over time getting worse in their audits. Their compliance rates are dropping. The number of complaints we're receiving against them are increasing. And it's time that we focus on that. And we're going to be addressing that and probably pretty aggressively. We're not there yet. But I would expect to see these changes here fairly shortly. So now is a really good time to start revamping your processes, start looking at your personnel and making sure that they're trained up on, you know, all of the benefits and the timelines and all that stuff. Now is a good time to start revamping things because if you are in this category of repeat violator, the landscape is going to start looking very different for you very soon. So something to bear in mind, and hopefully, you know, we can continue addressing issues that arise in this system and, you know, make it better for everybody. Truth be told, it is a fantastically healthy system. It's a great line of insurance, but we do have some problems that we're going to be addressing here very shortly. That is it for me. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me. My email address is on this slide here. And I will pass it off to Eric De La Cruz with Claims and Customer Services for their update. Thank you.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Erica De La Cruz, Deputy Commissioner of Claims and Customer Services. Thank you for joining us. Today, I'm going to talk about all the amazing things we do in customer service and how that benefits you as one of our stakeholders. I'd like to start by highlighting a couple of our customer service operations wins. Our average wait time, and that means you as a customer, when you're contacting us, the average amount of time that you're going to spend on hold for last year was 15 seconds. Yes, that is correct. It's not an error. It's 15 seconds. That is something that's really unheard of in the customer service world, and we're really proud of that in customer service operations. Our call capture rate, that's another call center stat. For the calls that are offered to our agency, we are answering 99% of those calls. So when you contact us, almost guaranteed that you will reach a customer service agent. And like I said, in 15 seconds or less. Quality assurance scores, that represents the scores that are given to our agents when we are evaluating their phone calls. For us, a passing score is 90%. Things that we are evaluating on our customer service calls are the information that they're providing you as our customer. We also evaluate soft skills like their tone, empathy, and we evaluate education that they provide our caller to. So things like predicting our caller's needs if you're calling about a specific topic, for instance, a designated doctor evaluation report, and now you want information about dispute resolution. So a passing score for us is 90%, and right now all of our agents are averaging 98%. So that's something that we're, again, very proud of because that means that they are providing excellent customer service to you. If you need to reach us, our number's on the slide, 800-252-7031, option one. We have queues in both English and Spanish, and we also have a dedicated queue for system participants who are just wanting to check the status of forms. Now we'll get into a couple of our outreach and claim services highlights. If you participated or joined us at our last carrier quarterly meeting, you will have heard from Teresa Johnson, who is the director of this section. Some amazing things that they're doing. Last time she highlighted their work in outreach and oversight of catastrophic incidents. This past year, they were tracking 5 incidents, which includes the latest one, which is the Kerr County floods. They've also processed about 3,000 requests for required medical examinations, around 300 applications for supplemental income benefits, and 230-ish requests for advance of income benefits. So this team processes many of the forms that you guys are submitting to the agency to request different actions. In addition, they've received 306 claims for death benefits. They do outreach not only to beneficiaries, but to first responders and working directly with them in their role as single point of contact. So every injured employee who has a claim has an assigned single point of contact. So if there is something that they're contacting the agency about and they need a little bit more assistance or some more in-depth hands-on help, then they can reach this team to get that help. Now we'll go into our subsequent injury fund and some great things that happened this year for them. They have adopted the verification of lifetime income benefits rule, which has outlined the process for which they'll verify the recipient information for our lifetime income benefits recipients. And we've got 21 of those injured employees who are receiving lifetime income benefits from the fund. And this team, the subsequent injury fund team, has hands-on communication and contact with these recipients every month. And that's basically what was outlined in that rule that was adopted. In addition, they have processed 358 insurance carrier reimbursement requests. That includes things like overturned designated doctor orders or decision and orders, multiple employment reimbursement requests. But there's a couple of different requests that are in that arena. Those requests have resulted in $8.8 million reimbursed to insurance carriers. So if you want any more information on the types of reimbursement requests that come into our office or where to find those forms, please visit the Subsequent Injury Fund website. You can follow that QR code on this page to take you there and learn more about the Subsequent Injury Fund in general. 2026 is going to be a fun year for us. Lots of things happening. One of those that may affect you is the relocation of our Lubbock field office. Excited about that. Love the new location. So we hope to bring that to you by the end of the year. We'll also be working on creating a Workers' Comp 101 training resource that you guys can use. So it'll be referred to on our training page. And hopefully that will be offered later this year as well. We will be exploring the use of AI. I know that's a very hot topic right now. And for customer service, we're looking forward to that being a new tool that we can use to make our agents even better than they are right now. We just took a look at the Subsequent Injury Fund webpage. Those are things we will be working on updating that page and potentially even the forms related to reimbursement. So keep an eye out for that. We're customer service, so a big thing that we do is educate. I want to take this moment to educate you guys about some tools that are available for you guys. So DWC has done a fabulous job in developing comp courses over the last couple of years. So follow this QR code. It'll take you to our comp courses page. You'll find some really cool topics on including employer responsibilities, understanding workers' compensation disputes, compliance, and employers' wage statement. So if you missed these comp courses when they happen, don't worry. You can watch them now. And like I said, we will have additional topics coming up over the next year. And excited to offer that to you all. If you participated in the quarterly a couple of sessions ago, you would have seen our demonstration of this new tool the benefits estimator. This is really neat. It can help you estimate average weekly wage, income benefit amounts, death benefit amounts. So it's a great tool for you, for your staff. It's also a great tool for injured employees who have questions about how their benefit amount was calculated. Sometimes it's a little easier for them to play with that information themselves. So follow the QR code. It'll take you to this new tool that's available on our webpage. Let us know if you have any questions about it.
Thank you. And thank you again for watching this. Again, we apologize for the troubles that we had. A few things I wanted to touch on in closing. To start, a lot of you have heard the news that Commissioner Brown is retiring from TDI and from the state of Texas after 23 years of service. She has done a tremendous amount of good for the insurance industry in Texas over her time. She's been working in this field for most of those 23 years. She was the workers' comp commissioner for 3 years. She was the insurance commissioner for 4 years. And I think we all owe her a debt of gratitude for all the work that she's done. It's often a thankless job, but she handled it with grace and poise. She has been a mentor to me for a long time. She's a friend. She's someone that I'm going to miss getting to work with on a day-to-day basis, but we wish her the best in her retirement. I know she is looking forward to being out in the country with her family and her animals, and I hope she is able to enjoy that. A few other things I did want to touch on. Looking ahead, we do have a few rule projects that I want to bring to your attention. The first is related to attorney's fees. Now, no decisions have been made if we're going to touch this rule or not. But I believe the last time the attorney fees were adjusted was in 2017. Obviously, we know inflation has been a big part of life the past few years. So it's been recommended to us that we take a look at that. In the next week or two, you're going to get a notification from us requesting information and input on what you think an appropriate rate might be and why for attorney's fees. Again, we're not even making the decision to go down that path yet, but we are just in the information gathering stage right now. So we hope when you see that notice from us that we get feedback from you, because that's really what we're looking for. Another rule that we're going to be working on this year is related to electronic transmission of information. A lot of you know that our statutes and our rules were written kind of at a time before email was very prevalent. So a lot of those correspondence requirements involve certified mail, snail mail, fax machines, things like that. We are working to open that up to just more modern communication, how we all communicate, mainly email. So we're working through how we're going to do that, but that is a project that we're working on that we really hope eliminates some friction problems, some friction costs, and it kind of just speeds up the process for everyone involved. We also have our AMA guides. We are still working on that project, moving from the 4th to the 6th edition. There will be a report coming out on that early this year. We're excited to get that out and keep this project moving forward so we can move from the 4th to the 6th edition. There's a lot of work that goes into that, not just rule writing, but also training and testing that goes into it. So it is going to be a significant undertaking, but one I think is necessary and what we're going to keep moving forward with. Another thing we're working on is revamping our website. We just want to take a look at the information that's out there, make sure it's not stale, make sure it's up to date, make sure it's easy to understand, make sure it's organized in a way that makes sense and is easy to navigate. So that'll be something that we are doing throughout the year, but expect to see changes to our websites to specific sections as the year progresses. And one thing that Dan did mention is related to our top violators. We have had consistent entities be our biggest problems for a long time. We are taking enforcement actions against them. We are not seeing a curb in behavior. So we're going to look for other avenues to address those major violators in our system. And these violators aren't usually the highest volume participants in our system. They just seem to have consistent problems that aren't being addressed. So as a regulator, it's our duty to kind of look for ways to figure out how to get compliance with some of these very common actions in our system. That's it for me for now. I did mention Commissioner Brown retiring. I do want to say that Amanda Crawford is coming in. She's going to be starting as commissioner of TDI at the beginning of February. We're excited to have her on board. We think she's going to do a great job. She comes with a wealth of experience. From everyone I've spoken to, she's a tremendous person. We're going to welcome her insights and look forward to working with her day in and day out. So with that, thank you again. There will be an opportunity to submit questions via email, and we appreciate your time. Thank you.